First Nations people in Canada have been kept out of society by design. This is also true of the healthcare system. It was very clear for Dr. Beauchart when, at a conference of around 300 medical professionals, she asked how many present had a relationship that was not physician-patient defined, a personal relationship, or had ever had a personal relationship with someone of the First Nations, and only one or two people raised a hand. This is the kind of system which people would see and not consider strange. We see this played out in cities all around the world where there are wealthy sections of society and not so wealthy sections of society. And this two-tier segregated situation is not only acceptable, but it has also become normal for the wealthier class and the poorer class. When people within society with authority, like a doctor, a lawyer, a police officer, or a teacher, have no understanding of the lived reality of minorities, indigenous peoples, despite everything that has happened, it begs a number of questions. How can we not know what our forebears have done? Why do we not learn what our legacy is? And what will it take for us to repair the damage of our transgenerational greed and corruption? For we should have no doubt, refusal to educate ourselves is a breach of humane conscience. People are only aware of the stereotypes, and they are satisfied to ignore whatever lies beneath or beyond the veil of ignorance. Indigenous communities have been through the racism, the prejudices, and the consequential socio-political alienation that Trumpian politics embraces. And so the First Nations people are not surprised. Dr. Beauchart herself states that she is used to these dynamics. When white supremacists want to take away opportunities designed to bridge the gap colonialism created, and they use words like meritocracy to justify it, then it stinks even more. What do these people know of suffering? Economic hardship? Well, join the club. Everyone is in that boat. How about facing constant attacks on your dignity, right to exist, right to heritage, right to your own indigenous lands, right to benefit from the fruits of the lands your ancestors helped nurture, and then on top of that, face the economic hardships others face? It's all a matter of perspective in the end. Thank you so much, Dr. Beauchart, for taking the time to set the record straight. Tuana Mike, no longer clocking out. Rise up.
Jepek kuduelo mabiro etu under mic. Dung parodit kod joke mawoye tu under mic. Seche tin sud buta wawinji etu under mic. Wola wachokre wabed ping biwawinje ero chako dumomit ndi
tu and a mic
podcast makende.
I'm joined once again by Dr. Beauchart. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me. How are you doing?
I am feeling really good today. It's Friday.
It is indeed. Dr. Beauchart, we've talked previously a lot about the healthcare that you provide, which is very much catered towards the provision of healthcare to First Nations, Indigenous people. You've spoken also before about barriers to healthcare. First of all, you've spoken about how difficult it is for Indigenous people themselves to perhaps become professionals within the healthcare system. There are barriers inherent within that system, the educational system. But yes. Then, of course, as well, with regards to the treatment that they receive. Can you talk a bit more about how this racism manifests itself?
Yeah, so there's, you know, in my experience, of course, with everything, there's like a large spectrum of what we call racism, right? There's like overt, like people that consciously choose, right? And then there's this large spectrum to like people that wouldn't even identify themselves as being racist. And they might call themselves benevolent Trumps. They're, you know, I don't know. There's this huge spectrum in the system of how people are operating. And I think, you know, as a product of colonization, a lot of, I hate generalizations, but to be honest, in this country, in Canada, it was an agenda, right? It's been an agenda of the government to sort of keep Indigenous or First Nations people out of society. And so there's this division, right? And we know that division creates misunderstanding and ignorance and racism. And so in the healthcare field, which I think can be applied across all of the different sectors, but especially within the healthcare system and the service delivery of healthcare, there aren't a lot of Indigenous people operating, right? And so I did a lecture recently about these issues to a group of family physicians in the area. I think there was about 300 people in the room. And I did ask that room of family doctors, you know, via one of those question, you can just text in your answers, right, on your cell phone. But like, how many of you have a relationship with an Indigenous person that is not physician patient, you know? And it was like one or two people in the 300 that in their life, in their day to day, have no relationship with someone who identifies as a First Nation person. And so that's just like glaringly obvious to me, like why the racism exists. And most of it isn't overt. It's just like they don't understand like who we are and how we operate and what the realities, the lived realities of our existence. And so when they're providing healthcare, they're only doing it from what they understand about what life is. And they also, if they don't have relationships with Indigenous people, then the only thing that they know about us is what they read or what they see on TV or what they see politically. And we sort of know that all of those narratives motivate anger and frustration. And so like this, like the overall narrative in this country that's been propagated through media and is that we, you know, we know the stereotypes, right, of Native people. I don't need to say them, but, you know, that's really all a lot of people know, right? And so these people become doctors and lawyers and teachers, and they take that with them, and then they have to interact with us in a position of power. And you could see how if they don't fully understand and they hold all these assumptions, then, it, you know, that can fall apart, right? So I guess, you know, it does exist. The divide exists. The healthcare is not what we need to be well. And the other piece to this is, and this is not my idea. This is a kind of a broader idea of how, like every human in the world, like is ancestors were, they're the descendants of tribes who are operating in an Indigenous way, right? We all come from people who were connected to the land and understood the world in a very different way, whether it's the tribes of Germany, right? Germanic tribes, or everyone at some point in their lineage was disconnected, you know, that disconnected from that way of being, right? And so some of us are more disconnected ancestrally from that real connection to who we are as human beings in this world, right? And the people who are very uncomfortable healthcare providers who are like, you know, I just feel uncomfortable, I don't know how to do it, some of the learning is about looking at themselves, right? And where they come from and when they got disconnected and why do they see the world like they see it? And do they even ask themselves these questions, right? But, you know, and looking at what they've learned about Indigenous people and how they feel and like doing all their own self-work, right? Are they willing to do it? It's up to each individual to do that work. And sometimes, you know, the racism is overt and I can't undo that. Like, and I don't try, it's not my job, but I've learned anyway, I can't approach people out of anger, like, or I've learned to be gentle. You know, I have to be gentle. Otherwise, I get labeled as an angry Indian woman, right? And we know that that is also a stereotype, and I can easily be dismissed by my physician colleagues or by leadership if I'm not acting in like a way that they feel comfortable with. So it's a very delicate art to talk about difficult issues like this, but I'm slowly building relationships with physicians in the area and offering to support their learning. And if I do come across a physician who, in my opinion, provided suboptimal care, like and ended in harm, you know, I'm getting more courage to just call it out. You know, and I actually, for the first time in the last month, I did have a physician call me back who like failed at his job. He was a specialist in infectious disease, and he called and he said, "You're right, like I totally missed this and I apologize. Clearly we haven't been helpful for this person, this patient of yours." And it was like the first time like a male physician had called and been honest that he failed and was willing to talk about why, right? And it was because he made all these assumptions that were incorrect, right? And it was a good reminder for him that with every patient encounter, you can't make any assumptions. You actually have to ask people questions and let them answer. So, you know, I in this work, I just think one day at a time, one interaction at a time, one physician at a time, one relationship at a time, because, you know, I can't change everything. And the system is full of people who don't think it's their responsibility to like be helpful to our community. You know, they have to do, yes, everyone, it's 50-50. The patient has to do the work, right? To take care of themselves. But if they don't know how and they don't understand, it's our job to help them, right? And I think the willingness to do that is very limited right now. So yeah, I guess racism is an ugly thing, but it happens we know ignorance and lack of understanding and lack of knowledge and division, right? So we have to be getting together more as humans, right? We have to sit with each other in a real personal way and get to know each other and talk about real things and not keep everybody so separate, right?
Yeah. I mean, you obviously, we started this conversation talking about racism, but some of the comments that you make also point towards sexism. Some people label you that angry Indian woman, as you suggested earlier. So therefore, you know, it's a double prejudice which is thrust in your direction. And when we sort of look south of the border with Canada, at least, that there is this onslaught with regards to DEI people. Which is very threatening and kind of attacks the very sense of diversity that you are embracing in your work. Is it worrying for you perhaps that some of these Trumpian influences may venture northwards?
Well, I always, whenever these things happen, I'm always observing, you know, the general society. And I'm thinking, like as Indigenous communities, we've been sort of like through the ringer. We're kind of not shocked by any of this, you know. It's like we know what it's like to be oppressed and to have these things happen, and so for me, like, I'm not affected by what's happening because I guess it's terrible to say, but I'm just used to, you know, these kinds of dynamics. I mean, DEI, yeah, I don't understand why it's such a, it's like othering, right? Like, I don't know. In some ways, I think it creates more of a divide where we have to do it in a way where it's like we're coming together. Like, we are seeing everybody as equal and we're not. I mean, the way that Trump is doing it feels very much like, you know, like white supremacy to me, like superiority. So I don't love that. But it still exists in the world. And I think as it gains power, then there's got to have to be an opposing, like equally opposing force of equality and justice and humanity, right? And so I'm hoping that will exist, and it does exist. It just doesn't get as much press, I guess. You know, because it is really about us all like having equal value as human beings, as a species, and we all have our gifts. And I do think that, like, you know, I was really upset by the specific efforts of, you know, allowing people space who are minorities or people of color to like have opportunity, like in job spaces or having a hiring policy where they're looking at that. You know, and that's personal to me because I entered into medical school through one of these kinds of programs, right? Where there was a different process for people who are Indigenous. And the thought that like they're just not as smart and you're gonna get less smart people or less qualified people in roles, like that's just frustrating to me because that's just not true, right? And it's just about opportunity, right? You could have the most brilliant, capable person, no matter what color, but if their circumstances aren't going to support them to grow in a certain way, right? If they are living in poverty because of oppression and racism and their families are broken down, maybe they have to work an extra job and they can't study enough for a test, right? It doesn't make them less valuable or less intelligent. It just means that the circumstances around them prevent them from succeeding, right? So these programs are trying to minimize those barriers to, like, you know. So I always think, well, if these programs are actually identifying people who are amazing and creative and have great skill sets and just giving them an opportunity to like show that, right? But from the perspective of these, you know, current people in power, there's still that narrative, like, you're just letting people who aren't qualified into roles because of their color. But that's not what's happening, you know? They're not, you know, this meritocracy is like, I think, easy for like a white man to say, right? Like, oh, everyone, you just have to earn it. If you didn't earn it, like, then you don't get it. But they've never had to suffer a real struggle, maybe, right? You know, and so anyway, that's my thoughts on that.
I've read quite a bit of the writings of African Americans, Malcolm X, and some of the prominent thoughts in that is you have to work twice as hard to get half as much. And it seems to me that that is also representative of the reality that you refer to.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I don't mind working twice as hard, but it's true. Like I do work very, very hard, and the system will still see me as like not as good. And do I care what the system or people think of me? Absolutely not. But we do have to work much harder, and we don't get twice as much back, you know, as everyone else. So I don't love, I keep seeing this meritocracy stuff. It's just driving me bonkers. And it's always white men that are talking about meritocracy. The ones who had like the most privilege and the most opportunity in the last 50 years, right?
Since the first time that we spoke, since before then, when I read your online posts, tweets as they were known in those days, you represent a part of the humanitarian resistance. And as you've said to yourself, you can't change the whole world, but you do attempt to change that little part of it where you can operate. That obviously provides you with a certain degree of satisfaction. What kind of things, I know we don't have too long, but what kind of things would you like to see from the local infrastructure to support the work that you do by enabling you to resist the racism and the prejudice that you've had to deal with?
What I would like to see is like putting resources. So, you know, the government puts a lot of words out, Indigenous health, and we're putting so much effort into supporting Indigenous health led by Indigenous people. But I always find it interesting that, you know, that I still like don't have a whole bunch of resources lined up, if that's true, right? It still seems like, well, we will support you, but it will be in our way, right? So we'll give you dollars for healthcare, but like you have to do it in the way we want you to do it, because that's our value system and our way. And so I won't accept any resources with that, if that's how it has to be. You know, so what I would love to see is that system provide resources and not tell me how to do it, but know that I am a person of integrity and I want to provide good care and I will utilize those resources in the best way for my community. And having that respect and that trust and that, you know, that still doesn't exist in my experience. It's always like, prove it, prove it, prove it. Or numbers. How many, you know, if you're not seeing this many numbers of people, then like there's no value to your work, right? So the organization that is supporting this little lower limb preservation, they're doing their best to support me in that way. But their funding is coming from an overseeing body who is not super happy about the fact that they're supporting me in the way that I think it needs to be done, right? You know, I understand resources are scarce and we got to utilize them in a good way, but they have to understand that sovereignty piece, that we should have the ability to do it in the way that makes sense to us. As Indigenous healthcare providers. And so, you know, ideally I would just get somebody to say, oh, here you go, Dr. Beauchart. Here's some resources, whether that's like physical resources or financial resources to support the work. And it's not dependent on their expectation, but on our community expectation, right?
Yeah, you mentioned in integrity, and I didn't want to ask any further questions, but I don't know if I'm permitted to ask this one, but you have attained a certain amount of international recognition. You've been invited to give a talk outside of your immediate province. Can you just quickly speak about how that came about and so on?
Yeah, so the work we're doing with the It's called the Middlesex London Ontario Health Team. So they are the ones that have been supporting the work in the lower limb preservation space. But that team submitted a abstract to a conference and on integrated care. And that conference is happening in Lisbon, Portugal. And we were accepted and asked to come speak at this conference in May. So I will be flying across the ocean and presenting about the work in Lisbon. Yeah, so that's exciting in a way. I like to keep my feet on the ground, but I might have to fly over there, yes.
Yeah, very good. I mean, I always enjoy catching up with you. It's we tend to leave it a few months at a time before we have the opportunity of doing so. But I mean, May is not too far away. So perhaps if you're free at some point thereafter, we could kind of catch up and you can tell us about your experience of flying over the ocean, but more so also about your experiences in Lisbon and what kind of support you will have achieved thereafter would be wonderful to hear.
And I wondered, there's one little story I wanted to tell for your listeners, because I think it's really interesting.
Please.
For me. So, and it came about because of you. So, if I don't know if you remember, like, you told me that you had a lot of listeners in a specific geographic region in the U.S.
Yep.
And I was like, I never heard of this place. So I did a Google search of this place, and then the Wikipedia article that came up was describing this place in the US, and then this name popped up in the article, Billy Caldwell, and I was like, that name's familiar. And it turns out Billy Caldwell was my fifth great-grandfather. and I was like, that's really strange, right? So even further to that, I learned about Billy Caldwell because they recently made a documentary film about him called The Negotiator. And he was a, like me, he was half breed, like, Mohawk. And I think, I can't remember if it's Scottish, but he was a very important figure in the Potawatomi, between the Potawatomi and the U.S. In land negotiation. And so as I watched this documentary, I learned so much. But, you know, he, even like his family, one of the women, I think it was his it was either his mother or his aunt. Her indigenous name was like almost the same as my daughter's indigenous name that was given through ceremony, right? So, So there's all these very interesting sort of things I can't explain about how these things go, right? And that's like that spiritual connection we talk about and our ancestors, such as Billy Caldwell, is like, he's there, right? And he's like, hey. Anyway, he letting me know who I am and the skills I have and how that flows through generations and so thank you for somehow shining the light on this little town in the USA where my great 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 grandfather settled and I got to learn about him. So
wow, a fantastic story.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah, thank you very much, Dr. Beauchat. Heartwarming and something that this podcast can always take away and be proud of. So thank you for that. All the best to you and your work and your community. Our greatest respect to everybody you work with within that community. And I look forward to hearing from you in the future.
Yes, look forward to catching up.
And a mic.